set. It is so good to see everybody here tonight. It's been really fun greeting everybody as they came in. There are some folks that I haven't seen in 25, 26 years that probably haven't heard me preach since I was in preacher training. You were so patient. It took you this long to go, man, I'm going to come back. It was that bad. I want to thank you all for being here. You're such a joy to the congregation. And I want to thank the congregation here for all the work that they've done getting ready for this gospel meeting. John was sharing with me just how many flyers that you've been passing out, how many got sent to the neighborhood around here. Thank you for the work that you're trying to do to save souls. Just at dinner tonight, there's an invitation to the waitress to come to the meeting. She was a little taken aback when she was asked, hey, what time you get off work? She was like, wait a minute. And he said, no, there's a gospel meeting. And if you get off early enough, you can come. And that made better sense. So thank you for the work that you're doing in the community here in this area, corner of the kingdom. And we're looking forward to the next couple of nights. Ann and the kids couldn't be here tonight. Lord willing, they'll be with us again tomorrow night. And I just appreciate all of you. Let's turn over in our Bibles to Exodus, and let's go to Exodus 32. So for those who weren't here yesterday morning, what we have set out to do this week is to look at the life of Moses and make application from his life to ours. And so yesterday morning during our Bible class period at 10, we started with the birth of Moses and spent most of our time in Exodus 1 and the first half of Exodus 2. And then yesterday morning during the sermon period, we looked at the rejection of Moses. We spent the rest of our time in Exodus 2 and looked at that time where Moses, this prince of Egypt, was rejected by the Israelites and also chased down by the Egyptians, and he fled into the land of Midian. And so just in those two chapters, you're looking at 80 years of history. I mean, there's just so much in there that we don't have insight into. However, we went and looked at some of the inspired understanding of Moses' life. We went to Hebrews chapter 11 to see what the Hebrew writer had to say about Moses' life. Those of us at the men's breakfast this morning talked a little bit more about that. And we also looked in Acts chapter 7 at Stephen's sermon, where by inspiration, he's explaining some things about Moses' perspective on his life and service to the Lord. We're not going to spend a lot of time talking about the plagues of Egypt. We're skipping forward quite a bit. But when you go through the Exodus event, at 80 years old, God calls Moses to send him back to Egypt. So for 40 years, he's been serving as a shepherd, and he's taking care of animals. And he's gotten married, and they've had kids, and he is content. What it says in chapter 2 is he was content to serve taking care of animals. It's not what he set out to do with his life, but it's what God used to humble him and prepare him for the next stage. And so at 80 years old, God calls him through the burning bush, and Moses turns aside to see the bush. And in choosing to focus on that, God speaks to him and sends him back. And through a series of revelation through plague, God reveals his power and strength above and beyond what the Egyptian gods have, and gets to the point that at the culmination of those plagues, at the death of the firstborn, Pharaoh sends them out. And the text says they plundered Egypt. The Egyptians just shower them with material blessings and shoo them out. And obviously you have the crossing, the miraculous crossing of the Red Sea, where God delivers them again from Egypt, but specifically the Egyptian army, and places the Red Sea as a barrier between the Israelites and Egypt. And so as the waves close over the army, there's like this closing of the door on their time in Egypt. And on the other side, in Exodus chapter 15, the people of Israel sing a song of celebration. And that song is going to carry through the centuries of the Israelites. As they write their poetry, especially in the Psalms, they're going to refer back to that song of deliverance. And so Moses, all the way through as he was interacting with Pharaoh, was saying, hey, I need to get these people to Sinai. Because what God told me to do was to lead them to the mountain to worship. And that's what he kept telling Pharaoh. I need to take the people to worship. I need to take the people to worship. Because God told him, you will bring the people back here. And so they get back to Sinai, and God comes down to meet with them. And it's an incredible meeting where the mountain catches on fire. It goes dark. The earth shakes. And the people are terrified of this manifestation of God's presence in front of them. And they're so terrified, they all take a step back and shove Moses and say, "You go talk to God." And Moses is perfectly fine to go talk to God. And I want you to think about that for just a second. Imagine for just a second that you're a wannabe carpenter. And so for your first project in your home, you're in the garage and you've got the tools that you've got, and it's probably not sufficient, but you build some kind of small box. And then you decide, you know what, I think it'd be fun to get into that box. And so you try to cram yourself into this box and close the lid, but it's not well made because it's your first time trying to make a box. What's going to happen to that box? Actually, you don't have to imagine it. What happens when your kids play with a cardboard box? After not too long, my kids have one torn apart. The box can't contain them. The box breaks at the seams. The tape fails. The corners get rough. Like, those kinds of structures are not made to hold this. And if you take that and then think about Sinai, what do you think it looks like when an incredible God who lives outside of everything and has created everything tries to step into his creation? How do you think the creation responds to that? There's not room here. Like, that's kind of how I imagine Mount Sinai. God's trying to make his presence known, but God is so incredible, the physical creation can't hold him. And it's groaning at this magnificent, powerful, all-knowing God trying to make his presence known to his people. And so Moses goes up and he interacts with God, and he's there for a little over a month. He's there for 40 days. And that's what gets us to Exodus chapter 32. Okay, so just for a second, let's start reading through the text a paragraph at a time and talking down through it, and we'll make some points at every paragraph. So starting in verse 1 of Exodus 32, the text says that when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, "Up, make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him." So Aaron said to them, "Take off the rings of gold that are in the ears of your wives, your sons and your daughters, and bring them to me." So all the people took off the rings of gold that were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. And I want to focus on that sentence just for a second because it's going to be significant at the end of the chapter. Aaron received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. Aaron was intimately involved in the process of the construction of the golden calf. And they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." And when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord, Jehovah, Yahweh, the covenant name of God." And they rose up early the next day and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Okay, let's talk down through this for a little bit, okay? Let's talk about the golden calf. It is really easy to be really critical of the Israelites. It's really easy to be critical because we live on this side of the cross. We live on this side of history. It's really easy to be a backseat driver to people that have lived thousands of years ago when God has plainly pointed out what foolish people they were. Like, it's really easy to call that play after it's already been called. So try to imagine you have no knowledge of anything past Exodus 32. All you know is that this large family of Hebrew people just came out of centuries of slavery. And the man that was at the front of the column has been up on a burning mountain for 40 days and you haven't seen him or heard from him. What would you conclude about that? And at breakfast, we were talking about this a little bit. We were talking about the Israelites and the way that that generation of freed people struggled and wrestled. And there was something that I read a couple of years ago. I think it was in late 2020 or maybe early 2021. I picked up a book that had a collection of the writings of Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass was an important figure in the civil rights movement here in the United States. He was born as a slave in the South, really doesn't even know what his original name was, Frederick Douglass. Frederick was not a part of that, and Douglass was not a part of that. He took a couple of names that were associated. He doesn't know what his real last name was. He suspects who he knows who his father was, but he never met his father. And what is fascinating about his book is the perspective that he brings to slavery and freedom. Because he became really, really, really articulate. One of his passions in life was trying to help freed slaves learn how to read. He tried to teach them how to read before they became free, which was illegal. But it was so important in his mind to teach people how to read that he taught them how to read anyway. But one of the things that he explained was something that he called the slavery mentality. What he said was that slavery dehumanizes both the perpetrator of slavery and the sufferer of slavery. Because you have to dehumanize yourself to hurt other humans that way, the way that they were in American slavery. And if you've been dehumanized by someone who is dehumanizing themselves, it dehumanizes you. And what they try to tell you about yourself, you start to kind of believe and think, especially if that's what you grew up with and your parents grew up in that and your grandparents grew up in that. You start to see yourself the way that they see you. And so even though you're set free, you still have these ideas in the back of your head about, well, I'm just not smart enough. And so as he tried to teach slaves how to read, they would say of themselves, we're not smart enough to do this. Why are you doing that? And he's like, but we are smart enough. No, we're not smart enough. Because they're believing what the oppressors told them about themselves. So even when they're set free, they take that with them. There's this little voice in the back of their heads, I'm not good enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not capable, and they keep looking back. Now think about the Israelites. All they have known for centuries is oppression. All they have known religiously for a really long time was Egyptian idolatry. All they have seen are those idols. And they've retained some memory of the God of Abraham. It's there, but it's been mixed up and jumbled with what they've seen for a lifetime. And so when they're set free and Moses is gone and they haven't been told when he'll come back, they don't know, they panic. And so in verse 1, they approach Aaron and say, up, make us gods who shall go before us. They want a God to lead them forward. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. That's true. They just don't know. And Aaron, in foolishness, but I think I understand what's going on, you have got all of these people that could really easily turn and start some really bad chaos. And all of them are putting pressure on you to do something. And so Aaron does. And he's the one who collects the gold, and he's the one who has the golden calf fashioned. And the calf is something that was venerated in Egypt, especially in the region that they came from. And so he fashions an idol for them that looks like something that they're familiar with, but then he attaches the name of God to it. Verse 5, tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord. And in verse 4, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. He's trying to jumble them together. Their familiarity with idolatry, but the reality of their deliverance, but attach it to the name of God. So even though it wasn't a wholesale, like, hard left turn, it was like he was trying to appease them and still keep it attached to Jehovah. And maybe that helps us be a little bit more compassionate. And even though that helps provide us with some understanding, the reality is that in those first 6 verses, Israel is unfaithful to the Lord. Israel's unfaithful. to the point that in verse 6, when they rose up early the next day and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. That word play in verse 6 is the same word that's used in Genesis 26, verse 8, to talk about Isaac being intimate with his wife. So what we've got going on is we've basically got an immoral party going on in a religious context, which is what they did in Egypt. So they're bringing their culture with them. And maybe to help understand Aaron's perspective a little bit more, I'm reading from the ESV, but when you look at verse 5, the ESV says, "When Aaron saw this," the New English Bible says, "Then Aaron was afraid." The Durham Bible says, "When Aaron saw their reaction." The CEV says, "When Aaron saw what was happening." I mean, you put all that together, Aaron was reading the room. He was reading the room. And he was afraid of what might happen if he didn't give in to them in some way. And you remember yesterday when we were talking about how Moses did not let fear make the final choice for him. Aaron did. Aaron did let fear drive his decision making, and it was a poor decision. Okay? And let's give a little bit more maybe context to what the golden calf looked like. Really, I should have thrown up here on the next slide. When we teach the golden calf in our kids' classes, what does the cow look like? I had a picture, and I don't know where it went. I'll have to look for it for the next time I do this lesson. There's usually, in the coloring sheet, you've got a stone table that's about as tall as this podium, maybe a little bit bigger, and you might have a life-sized cow, golden calf, on top of it. Some of the pictures that I've seen, the cow is actually smaller than life-size. Okay? And I just want to share this with you and see what it does in your understanding with this. So put a pin in Exodus 32, and for Bible students, think about later on in Israel's future, in 1 Kings. Because in 1 Kings, you have the division of Israel into the northern and southern kingdoms, the separation between Jeroboam and Rehoboam. And Jeroboam, up in the northern kingdom, is so scared that people in his kingdom would keep going back down to Jerusalem to worship the Lord. He doesn't want them crossing the border. And so he establishes places to worship Jehovah in the north and in the south of his kingdom. One's closer to the border, but one's up at the northern border. And what's fascinating is that in the northern area of Israel, they found his worship site. So that's a picture that I took when I visited there. It's the cultic site at Tel Dan. And there's so much neat stuff at Tel Dan. But I want you to look at that for a second. Do you see the metal cube on the left? That represents the size of the original altar. So you see the guy in the red t-shirt that's up on the steps next to it? Those steps would have continued going up the side until they could have put the burnt offerings on top of that altar. So imagine how big that altar was. Now, where was the golden calf? There's a textbook that's used for tour guides and college students in Israel, and I got a copy of the page from that. Do you see the altar on the lower left corner? So this is that. Those steps are these steps. That represents a person. And then that represents the size of the golden calf that would have been on the platform. Much bigger than life size. And just as a side note, that's the northern border of Israel. And just an interesting footnote, that when Jews built synagogues, typically the doorways faced Jerusalem. They want people facing Jerusalem because that's where the temple was supposed to be. That's where the Holy of Holies was supposed to be. That's where the altar was supposed to be. That's where God was supposed to be. That's where he caused his name to dwell. With this, every part of that faces north. As people walk up those steps to offer their offering, their back is turned toward Jerusalem. The golden calf, as you approach the golden calf, your back is toward Jerusalem. You are literally turning your back on God when you go to this site. So it's not just physically what your body is doing. Your body is actually mimicking what your heart and your spirit is doing. You're turning your back on the Lord. Now, I don't know how big the golden calf was, but you think about all of the gold that was collected from all of those people, and it makes a little bit more sense to me that the golden calf was probably more significant than what we put on our coloring sheets. And it was probably elevated pretty high so that everybody could see it. Higher than what this little table would have been. Now, I understand they're in the wilderness, and I understand something needs to be portable, but I think it's more substantial than what we imagine it to be. Okay, now, come back to Exodus 32, and let's continue our reading in verse 7. The Lord said to Moses, "Go down, for your people whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way that I commanded them. They have made for themselves a golden calf and have worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, 'These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt.'" And just put yourself in God's position. Like, he has just delivered all of these people. He has, like, unquestionably demonstrated who he is to Pharaoh. Some of those plagues I wish I could have seen from, like, satellite. You realize the plague of darkness, what that would have looked like from a satellite? Because the plague of darkness covered all of Egypt, except where the children of Israel lived. They had light. So if you saw that from space, close enough, dark, 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 but these communities of light. You know how cool that would have looked? And what that tells us about who we are as God's people? Like, God demonstrated so clearly through the plagues who he was and what he did at the Red Sea. And these people were so excited. And he's up on the mountain meeting with Moses, and they're reviewing the Ten Commandments and all of the rules to help them lead forward as a nation. And just think about that. Moses makes this point in Deuteronomy. You had 70 people go into Egypt, according to Exodus chapter 1. And you had hundreds of thousands, if not over a million people, leave. And they left, and when they got to Canaan, they were a nation. They went in, a bunch of families, they came out a country looking for a home because they had an army and they had a law and they had worship and they had all of these things. All they needed was property. And Moses' point in Deuteronomy is, what nation is there on the earth that started this way? And the answer is, there's no nation like this. And so they're at the mountain getting the law from the Lord, and as the ink is drying on the paper, figuratively speaking, they're down breaking it. And so God is the one who tells Moses, you need to get down from here because your people are already really messing up. And he says something in verse 9, the Lord said to Moses, "I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore, let me alone that my wrath may burn hot against them and I may consume them in order that I may make a great nation out of you." And there's some interesting things to say here. God has every right to be angry. And he says something in verse 9 that's really significant, and we all need to pay attention to it. God said, "I have seen this people, and behold, it's a stiff-necked people." He uses a phrase that's associated with cows. A stiff-necked people. And for the rest of Israel's history, when they rebel against God, God is going to call them a stiff-necked people. He describes them as a stubborn cow. And there's a significance to that. I'll read the psalm for you, but if you want the reference for your notes, in Psalm 115, verses 4 through 8. Psalm 115, verses 4 through 8, God says this, talking about idolatry. "Their idols are silver and gold, the work of human hands. They have mouths, but do not speak, eyes but do not see. They have ears but do not hear, noses but do not smell. They have hands but do not feel, feet but do not walk, and they do not make a sound in their throat. He's talking about idols. They're dead. They don't do anything for you. But then in verse 8, he says, those who make them become like them. So do all who trust in them. And the principle in that psalm is this, and this is what God is trying to communicate back in Exodus 32. You become like what you worship. It's just a truth. You become like what you worship. We worship a true and living God, which means I have life. And that's amazing, and that's what God wants us to have. But if you worship a dead, dumb, mute, ineffective hunk of something, spiritually that's what you will be. Dead, dumb, deaf, and mute. You become like what you worship. They were choosing to worship a golden calf. God calls them a bunch of stiff-necked cows. And we need to be thinking about that. I want to make sure that I'm worshiping the true God who loves and is compassionate and cares and speaks truth so that I become more like him. And then he says something else in verse 10. God's ready to execute judgment on these people. Therefore, let me alone that my wrath may burn hot against them and I may consume them. And let's just say this about God's wrath. When we read about God's wrath, we superimpose our wrath on his. We think God's wrath is like our wrath. That's just not true. Like, my wrath can burn really hot. My wrath can exceed what is just. My wrath can be out of control. God's wrath is never that way. God's wrath is always appropriate to the occasion. God's wrath is measured. God's wrath is intentional. God's wrath is just. So when he turns to Moses and says, look, I've seen these people and I'm going to wipe them out and I'm going to start all over again with you, God could have done that. And he would have been right to do it. So let's point out, God was angry with them for being unfaithful. Let's pick up in verse 11. But Moses implored the Lord his God. Let's stop for a second. I don't want to go too far. What if you were Moses? I'll tell you something. I appreciate Moses more and more the older I get. And the more life I have behind me, the older my kids get, I have more and more appreciation for Moses. Because if Moses were any less of a man, he would have pulled up a camping chair and said, let's get at it. If Moses was any more prideful of a leader, he's like, yep, I'm done with them too. We can do better, God. That is a great idea. And he didn't. And I think it's because Moses had the heart of a shepherd. Moses had developed the heart of a shepherd. And he cared about them. And he was thinking not just about them, but he was thinking about God, and he was thinking about how unbelievers would have perceived all of this. Verse 11, but Moses implored the Lord his God and said, O Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you've brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? And pay attention to this. The people said, where's the man Moses who brought us out? And even God was like, hey, you need to get down there because these people who you have brought out. And Moses is like, no, you brought them out. You brought them out with great power and with a mighty hand. Why should the Egyptians say, with evil intent did he bring them out, to kill them in the mountains and consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from your burning anger and relent from this disaster against your people. Remember Abraham and Isaac and Israel, your servants, whom you swore by your own self and said to them, I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I have promised I will give your offspring, and they shall inherit it forever. And the Lord relented from the disaster that he had spoken of bringing on his people. That is a servant leader. That is a shepherd. It reminds me so much of 1 Samuel 17, 34 through 35. 1 Samuel 17, where David is about to go out and face off with Goliath, and Saul's like, man, why are you doing this? Like, I'm not even willing to do this. And I don't understand. And of course Saul didn't understand because he didn't have the heart of a shepherd. He had the heart of a coward. But David says, your servant used to keep sheep for his father. And when there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock, I went after him. I struck him and delivered it out of his mouth. He's like, the job of a shepherd is to preserve life. The job of a shepherd is to look out for the sheep or the goats at the expense and risk of his own safety. And I think Moses has figured that out. So Moses interceded in verses 11 through 14. In verse 15, Moses turned and went down from the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, tablets that were written on both sides. On the front and on the back they were written. And the tablets were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets. And when Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, there's the noise of war in the camp. And he said, it's not the sound of shouting for victory or the sound of the cry of defeat, but the sound of singing that I hear. And as soon as he came near the camp and saw the calf and the dancing, Moses' anger burned hot, and he threw the tablets out of his hands and broke them at the foot of the mountain. He took the calf that they had made and burned it with fire and ground it to powder and scattered it on the water and made the people of Israel drink it. Man, there's so much in here. I mean, one of the things is Moses has learned to see things the way that God sees things. And Moses' emotions have come in sync with God's emotions. And that's actually part of our sanctification. When we are children of God and we are disciples of Jesus, we learn to think like they think and feel like they feel. And so Moses, when he finally comes down and witnesses it with his own senses, he feels about it the way God felt about it, and he gets angry. And he did not sin by throwing those tablets down. It was an illustration of what the people had spiritually done. They had already broken the covenant, so let's break it. And he broke the tablets of testimony. And then he does something interesting that kind of threw me for a while. In verse 20, that is a weird thing to do with the idol. That's weird. Verse 20, he took the calf that they had made and burned it with fire and ground it to powder and scattered it on the water and made the people of Israel drink it. What is going on with that? And there are a couple other places in the Old Testament where something similar is done to idols. In 1 Kings 15, verse 13, Asa defiled the image of Asherah by cutting it down and burning it by a brook where the remains of it would be scattered. That's 1 Kings 15, 13. In 2 Kings 10, 25 through 27, Jehu destroys the house of Baal and turns it into a latrine. What's going on here? First thing, you remember back in verse 4, when the golden calf was made, there are three words used to describe its creation. Aaron received the gold, he fashioned it, and made it. So three different verbs to describe its creation. He received, fashioned, and made. And in its destruction, three things happened. It was burned and ground and scattered. So textually, you have a link of its creation and destruction. But there's more to it than that. And teenagers, don't start giggling, okay? You take this metal and you turn it into a powder and you drink it. Does it stay in your body for forever? No. Let's be really tactful. Your body eliminates it, okay? There are a couple of ways that your body eliminates things, and we'll just let your imaginations leave there. Guess what? That is considered unclean. And so this idol, this God, is defiled by God. And defiled in such a way and dispersed in such a way that it would be impossible to recreate it with those materials. And so these people that were worshiping and partying and dancing and being immoral all around this object, all of a sudden that object is literally gone. And it is so disgusting, you will never make it again. And once again, God shows that he's God and that that thing is not. I think that's pretty powerful. And so what God does is he defiles it so they can't return to it. In verse 21, Moses said to Aaron, "What did this people do to you that you have brought such a great sin upon them?" Like brother to brother, were they waterboarding you? Like what on earth? I was gone 40 days. Like they had to have been pulling out your fingernails with pliers. What did they do to make you do this? And Aaron in verse 22 said, "Let not the anger of my Lord burn hot. You know the people, that they're set on evil." Look, you know these people are bad. And then they said to me, verse 23, "Make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what's become of him." Well, that's true. Verse 23 is true. Verse 24, "So I said to them, let any who have gold take it off. So they gave it to me, and I threw it in the fire, and out came this calf." Like, come on. We got all this gold and kind of pitched it in, and out came this golden calf. It was amazing. I didn't do it. It just manifested itself. He's got to think that Moses is the slowest guy in the world. Now, it's interesting. Moses doesn't push this right now, but Aaron is just flat out lying about his responsibility. He is trying to deceive Moses, and he's self-deceived. He's trying to deny his guilt. "I'm not guilty." Verse 25. "When Moses saw that the people had broken loose, for Aaron had let them break loose," like the very next verse, the Bible is very plain. This is on Aaron. "Aaron had let them break loose to the derision of their enemies," which is another important point. What they're doing right now, the enemies of Israel are mocking God because of what they're doing right now. And that's what happens when we sin. Verse 26, "Then Moses stood in the gate of the camp and said, 'Who is on the Lord's side? Come to me.' And all the sons of Levi gathered around him. And he said to them, 'Thus says the Lord God of Israel, put your sword on your side, each of you, and go to and fro from the gate to gate throughout the camp, and each of you kill his brother and his companion and his neighbor.' And the sons of Levi did according to the word of Moses. And that day about 3,000 men of the people fell. And Moses said, 'Today you have been ordained for the service of the Lord, each one at the cost of his son and of his brother, so that he might bestow a blessing on each of you this day.'" The sons of Levi cleanse the camp. Because even with Moses coming down and the breaking of the tablets and this confrontation between the two brothers, people were still going crazy. They hadn't stopped. There were people that had not stopped. And so Levi is going through the camp, killing the people that were still engaged in the immorality. And then in verse 30, "The next day, Moses said to the people, 'You have sinned a great sin.'" And I just want to stop here again for a second. All sin is sin, okay? Sin is sin is sin is sin. I believe that. But some sin has greater significance than others, and some sin has greater influence than others. And this is a big deal. And that's what Moses is saying. What just happened here yesterday was a big deal. And I've got to go talk to God. I'm going to go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin. I want you to think about that. Moses is like, I'm going to go up there and I'm going to do what I can and I am going to try to atone for you. And so in verse 31, Moses returned to the Lord and said, "Alas, this people has sinned a great sin. They have made for themselves gods of gold. But now if you will forgive their sin..." And in my Bible, there's a long dash because he leaves it unsaid. "But if not, please blot me out of your book that you have written." Do you realize what he just said? He told the Israelites, "I'm going to go up and see if I can atone for you," which means cover over. I'm going to try to cover over your sin. I am going to try to cover over your sin. And then he goes up and he confesses to God this was a really big deal. And he begs God to forgive them. And then he says, "If you can't forgive them, then erase me from your book." He's offering himself for them. He's saying, "I'm willing to be cast out. I'm willing to be excluded as long as you'll keep them safe. Now, we hinted at the shepherd's heart earlier when he kept God's wrath from being poured out on them, but it's getting more personal here. And God's answer is powerful in verse 33. The Lord said to Moses, "Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of my book." Like, Moses, you can't do it. Everyone is individually responsible. But he relents in verse 34 and says, "Now go, lead the people to the place about which I have spoken to you. Behold, my angel shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I visit, I will visit their sin upon them." And then the Lord sent a plague on the people because they made the calf, the one that Aaron made. And so the chapter ends with Aaron getting credit for what he did, despite him saying, "I never did." What an incredible, incredible example. Do you know the word that we use in English to describe what Moses just did? It's intercession. He tried to intercede for the people. Because he realized they couldn't do it on their own. He was trying to do it for them. And God ended up saying, "I can't accept your sacrifice. I can't accept your intercession." They've got to take responsibility for themselves. Maybe another way to say that, which is a New Testament word, is he offered himself as propitiation. He tried to offer himself as the sacrifice that would appease God's wrath instead of them paying the price. That's propitiation. That's what Moses was trying to do. Now, y'all have been super patient, and this is what we've been doing this week. It's really two sermons jammed into one, but you get the second one in like less than 10 minutes. Because Jesus is our intercessor. And Jesus did what Moses could not. And what we've been pointing out every sermon is by going to Deuteronomy chapter 15 and 13, where in his final sermons before he dies, Moses tells the people, "God will raise up a prophet like me in the later days. Listen to him." That someone would be coming down the line that would be similar to Moses. And when that prophet shows up, you're supposed to pay attention to him. That prophet was Jesus. And so in so many ways, the lives of Moses and Jesus parallel each other. And so just a couple of points, and we'll go through these pretty quick. In Romans chapter 5, one of the things that Paul emphasizes in the first third of that chapter is that we have been unfaithful to the Lord. We are hostile to God. We are his enemies. We are weak. We are unable to fix our relationship with the Lord. And I'll flip over there and read those passages. I just don't want to paraphrase. Romans chapter 5, starting in verse 6. "For while we were still weak, at the right time Christ died for us, for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person one would dare even to die. But God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Since therefore we have now been justified by his blood, much more shall we be saved by him from the wrath of God. For if while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his son, much more now that we are reconciled shall we be saved by his life." And what I'm really trying to emphasize there is verse 6, verse 8, and verse 10. We were weak, we were sinners, we were enemies. We were unfaithful to the Lord. And if you go to the beginning of Romans, especially verse 18 and 32, Paul's making the point, God is right to be angry with us. We deserve the just wrath of God. Every single person. And we'll look at a lot of verses here in just a second. But Jesus interceded. Jesus interceded. Jesus was our propitiation. If you go back in Romans to chapter 3, starting in about verse 24, "We are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a propitiation by his blood to be received by faith." Jesus was our intercessor. What he says in Romans chapter 6 is that we shouldn't return to our unfaithfulness. We shouldn't return to our idolatry. We shouldn't return to our life of sin and slavery. We shouldn't turn our bodies over to be instruments of unrighteousness. God wants that to be destroyed. Over in 1 John chapter 1, verses 8 through 10, He talks about not being deceived. Don't be self-deceived. Be willing to confess your sin. And in 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 11, Paul talks about how we have been cleansed. We've been washed, we've been justified. And we're going to look at so many verses that talk about how Jesus successfully gave his life for ours. In John 1:29, as John the Baptist saw Jesus approaching, told everyone who was around him, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." He's about to do what Moses could not. He can be the one who makes atonement. In John 15:13, Jesus said, "Greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends." Jesus was going to be able to do what Moses could not. In Romans 3:24-25, what we just read, God put Jesus forward as a propitiation by his blood. In Romans 5:7-8, Christ died for us. Galatians 3:13-14, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. For it is written, "Cursed is everyone who is hanged on a tree." So that in Christ Jesus, the blessing of Abraham might come to the Gentiles, so that we might receive the promised Spirit through faith. So what are some points that we can make through all of this? And I hope you see the correlation between Moses and Christ. Moses had a tremendous heart and a willingness to meekly offer himself, but it wasn't sufficient. Christ's was. And so the points that I'd like to leave us with are these. The reality is that everyone sins and you cannot fix it alone. Those Israelites couldn't fix it on their own. No one else can fix it on their own. That's why we need Jesus. We need Jesus to make atonement. We need Jesus to justify. We need Jesus to sanctify. The truth is, we all deserve God's wrath. It wasn't too long ago, I was watching a YouTube video of a Christian apologist who's died in the last couple of years, but I really love some of the books that he wrote. He was kind of like our generation's C.S. Lewis. And he was giving a presentation, and there was a Q&A, and someone was asking him, you know, you're really hammering on us. What would you say to people that the gospel is really hard on self-esteem? I loved his answer. And he's this guy from India, and he's got this really soft-spoken voice, and he got the microphone, and he was like, "If it weren't for Jesus, we wouldn't be worth a sack of sand." Like, I think we forget that we're animated dirt and we think too highly of ourselves. And his point is, we all deserve God to be angry with us. Every single person. And we all stand before the foot of the cross needing that sacrifice. And no one's above anybody else. We all deserve to be obliterated. Like if God wanted to knock us all out and start over again, just like with Israel, he had every right to do it. And we all need to humble ourselves and accept that reality. We all deserve God's wrath. And just like Aaron, we need to not deceive ourselves about our guilt. No one should deny their sin or say, "I haven't sinned," 1 John 1. Don't deceive yourself about your guilt. And then the great part is, the life of Jesus was given in your place. You don't deserve what Jesus did for you. I don't deserve what Jesus did for me. There's not a soul alive that does. If it weren't for Jesus, if it weren't for God, we wouldn't be worth a sack of sand. We need to be so grateful for what Jesus has done for us and the fact that he could do what Moses could not, that Moses pointed to Jesus. And if we appreciate that and understand that, then we need to be transformed and not want to go back. We need to do everything that we can do to get rid of the slavery mentality where we keep looking back. We need to overcome the affections of the things and the life that we used to have and instead look forward to the rest that we have in Jesus. And then try to help the next generation do it even better than we've done it. I hope this has been encouraging, and I hope you better appreciate Moses, and I hope you better appreciate Jesus and what he's done for us. And if there's somebody here tonight who has not yet been reconciled to God, somebody who hasn't been delivered from their sin yet, you can be. You can be washed and sanctified and justified. You can become a child of God if you believe that Jesus really is the Son of God who died for you, and you're willing to put him on in baptism. You can become a child of God tonight. And for those of us who have become children of God, let's better follow him. Let's get rid of our slavery mentality. Let's be more and more transformed into the image of Christ. And let's help the next generation do it better. And if you haven't and you need prayers for that and encouragement with that, we'd like to do that. And I know the congregation here would like to help you do that. If there's anyone that needs to respond, please come to the front as we stand and sing this invitation song.